property issue. Some placards were strangely verbless. Hemp and International Criminal Court. I sent Max to find out why someone was holding up a swath of hot pink synthetic mohair cloth. "It's a rallying point for Wesleyan students," said a Wesleyan student in a deviant queer t-shirt. At the front of the crowd, a banner was being waved, either wholly opposite or completely out of place. Shame on dual loyalists. A truck with loudspeakers carried children singing songs of peace. The music was drowned out by young men on another truck with loudspeakers. First they intoned, "The Muslims united will never be defeated," and then, "Stop the killing, stop the war." A middle-aged woman dressed as a fairy godmother rollerbladed between the trucks with a bullhorn. She warbled, "Money for justice, not for bombs. Money for schools, not guns. Money for Social Security, too, when we stop the war," more or less to the tune of Bippity-Bobbity-Boo from the Disney cartoon Cinderella. What united these people other than a general loserish quality? Or maybe it was only that. They've made every question a political question, because in politics, as this political demonstration proved, there is no quality control. But the Arab Americans didn't look like losers. That's all right. Staking a claim to victimhood has value for even the most successful Americans. Witness Oprah, Rosie, the recent steel tariffs, a farm subsidy bill benefiting vast wheat and cotton plantations, and the complaints of the sandwich generation, moms pressed in their upper middle class lives between the demands of spoiled young children and those of crabby, affluent parents. Property rights are to be had in victimhood. Then there is the charm of a good tantrum, familiar to those of us with a three-year-old in the house. The less meliorable the cause of tears, the better the tantrum is. Also, blame negates responsibility. Who spilled Coca-Cola all over the third world and crayoned on its walls? The World Bank did. The wonder is not that 75,000 people showed up on April 20th, 2002. The wonder is that we all didn't. The demonstration was fully assembled. Marchers from every participating organization had arrived on the mall. It was a time for the stirring orations. The speaker's platform was ready by the reflecting pool where Martin Luther King Jr. once stood. But 39 years later, it was Cynthia McKinney who strode to the podium. She is the Georgia congresswoman who apologized to Saudi Prince Al-Walid bin Talal for Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's refusal of the prince's $10 million check for terrorist victims. She also issued a statement saying, "I am not aware of any evidence showing that President Bush or members of his administration have personally profited from the attacks of 9/11. A complete investigation might reveal that to be the case." And in a speech on recycling, she said, "Paper continues to be made from trees." Representative McKinney called on people from all walks of life, students, union members on strike, homeless veterans. These were all the walks of life she named. She called on the people in them to do something that I could not hear. The members of the crowd had turned away and begun chatting loudly among themselves. Max and I walked to the metro. We saw a man who had been on the fringes of various demonstrations all day. He had a sign of his own. "God please everyone." 8. Thoughts on the Eve of War. Not that I disagreed with everything said by the people who opposed the war with Iraq. As a casus belli, weapons of mass destruction did seem like a pair of pants cut to the size of North Korea and into which Iraq was being stuffed. And claims that Saddam Hussein was cooperating with Osama bin Laden smelled of something found on the Internet late at night, along with proof that the Jews and the Rotary Club control the World Bank. What President Bush should have said was, "Here's a man who's been murdering everyone he could get his hands on for 25 years. We don't need a reason. We're going to do to Iraq's dictator what Hollywood does to its has-beens at the Academy Awards ceremony. We're giving Saddam Hussein a Lifetime Achievement Award." And I don't blame most nations for not supporting the United States. The world is full of loathsome governments run by criminals, thugs, and beasts. When President Bush mentioned regime change, hairy little ears pricked up all over the earth. Beads of sweat broke out on low, sloping brows. Blood-stained, grasping hands began to tremble. Poor Colin Powell had to get on the phone to various hyenas in high office and explain to them that America itself was in need of regime change from 1992 to 2000, and we didn't precision bomb the fellow who was responsible, and we only impeached him a little. Kim Jong-il, Robert Mugabe, and Jacques Chirac should quit worrying. They should look upon Bill Clinton and know the fate that awaits them is a lucrative lecture tour, a big book contract, and many willing, plump young women. The United Nations Security Council offered a weak and vacillating response to Iraqi provocations. This timidity undermined the power and prestige of the UN, to the profound relief of all thinking people. A potent and esteemed United Nations would be in danger of evolving into a true world government. The individual nations of the earth could become the political equivalents of the individual states of America. Upholding the dignity of the Senate in these United States of Earth would be the sovereigns of Turkmenistan, Libya, Sudan, and such, each wielding tremendous power of seniority since election opponents all conveniently died. Meanwhile, the House of Global Representatives would be given over to debate between rioting Hindus from the subcontinental delegation and across the aisle, mainland Chinese chanting in perfect unison praise of free markets and the great helmsman. The world would have a North Korean Secretary of Agriculture, a head of the DEA from Cali, Colombia, 9 Palestinian suicide bombers on its Supreme Court, an Albanian chairman of the SEC, a dozen warring Liberian Joint Chiefs of Staff, and a French Surgeon General telling us we're using too much soap for our health. We owe a debt of gratitude to the non-aligned countries that oppose the Iraq war, and we owe a debt of gratitude as well to our erstwhile allies. We should understand the white-feathered, clucking German response to the prospect of combat in Iraq. Understand it for the good thing it is. Germans have turned into poultry with BMWs. What caused this is a mystery, but a splendid mystery given the behavior of Germany in the last century, and for that matter since the time of Tacitus. We witness with relief the Boche squawking behind the Rhine, henpecked by even the French. When Germany asks for peace, we are obliged to say yes, yes, the Versailles Treaty kind. And France is a treasure to mankind. French ideas, French beliefs, and French actions form a sort of lodestone for humanity. A moral compass needle needs a butt end. Whatever direction France is pointing toward, collaboration with Nazis, accommodation with communists, existentialism, Jerry Lewis, or UN resolution veto, we can go the other way with a quiet conscience. 9. Kuwait and Iraq, March and April 2003. Why is Iraq so easy to harm and so hard to help? After 8 days of war, U.S. troops had arrived at Karbala, 60 miles from Baghdad. Misery had arrived everywhere. But humanitarian relief had gotten only as far as Safwan and Qasr, just across the border from Kuwait. I could see one reason that relief had gone no farther. I was outside Safwan on March 28th on the roof of a Kuwait Red Crescent tractor trailer full of food donations. Below, a couple of hundred shoving, shouldering, kneeing, kicking Iraqi men and boys were grabbing at boxes of food. Red Crescent volunteers provided the boxes, gingerly, to the mob. Each white carton would be grasped by 3 or 4 or 5 belligerents and pulled in 3 or 4 or 5 directions. Tug of Congolese civil war. Every person in the mob seemed to be arguing with every other person, giving in to conflicting impulses to push themselves forward and pull others away. Shouting Iraqis were propelled in circles. A short, plump, bald man sank in the royal. A small boy, red-faced and crying, was crushed between 2 bellowing fat men. An old man was trampled trying to join the fray. The Iraqis were snatching the food as if they were starving, but they couldn't have been starving, or they wouldn't have been able to snatch so well. Most looked fully fed. Some were too fit and active. Everyone behind the trailer was expending a lot of calories at noon on a 90-degree day. Looking out, I saw irrigated patches in the desert, at about the same density as the patches on the uniform of a mildly diligent Boy Scout. The tomatoes were ripe. Nannies, billies, and kids browsed between garden plots. Goat bolognese was on offer, at least for some locals. There was no reason for people to clobber one another. Even assuming that each man in the riot and each boy was the head of a family, and assuming the family was huge, there was enough food in the truck. Muhammad Al-Kandari, a doctor from the Kuwait Red Crescent Society, had explained this to the Iraqis when the trailer arrived. Al-Kandari was a forceful explainer. He resembled a beneficent version of Bluto in the Popeye comics, or Bluto in Animal House. Al-Kandari had persuaded the Iraqis to form ranks. They looked patient and grateful, the way we privately imagine the recipients of food donations looking when we're writing checks to charities. Then the trailer was opened, and everything went to hell. Al-Kandari marched through the Donnybrook and slammed the trailer doors shut. He harangued the Iraqis. They lined up again, the trailer was opened, and everything went to hell. Al-Kandari waded in and closed the trailer doors again. He swung his large arms in parallel arcs at the Iraqis. "Line up," he boomed. "Cue," he thundered. The Arabic-speaking doctor speaking to Arabic speakers in English, as if no Arabic word existed for the action. Al-Kandari took a pad of post-it notes and a marker pen from his lab coat pocket. "Numbers," he said, still speaking English. "I will give you all numbers." A couple of hundred shouldering, shoving Iraqi men and boys grabbed at the post-it notes. The doctor gave up and opened the trailer doors. I climbed the ladder behind the truck cab to get a better view. Aid seekers in England would queue automatically by needs, disabled war vets and nursing mothers first. Americans would bring lawn chairs and sleeping bags, camp out the night before, and sell their places to the highest bidders. The Japanese would text message one another, creating virtual formations, getting in line to get in line. Germans would await commands from a local official, such as the under-supervisor of the town clock. Even Italians know how to line up, albeit in an ebullient wedge. The happier parts of the world have capacities for self-organization so fundamental and obvious that they appear to be the pillars of civilization. But here, on the road to Ur in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, where civilization has obtained for 5,000 years longer than it has, for example, at a Libertarian Party confab in Phoenix, nothing was supporting the roof. What I saw, however, wasn't anarchy. British soldiers stood nearby, emirs of everything within rifle shot. The Iraqis did not use weapons or even fists in the aid scramble. Later, a British soldier said, "We try to stay out of crowd control, because it looks like we're trying to stop the aid distribution, but we can't let them start fighting." They did start fighting. A few Iraqis hit each other with sticks. They fought, however, at the front end of the truck. British soldiers broke it up. The Iraqis didn't try to climb into the tractor trailer or break through its side doors. Red Crescent volunteers coming and going from the back of the truck were unmolested. Once an aid box was fully in an Iraqi's control, and had been pulled free from the commotion, no one tried to take it. I saw four boxes being guarded by a 7-year-old boy. I watched a confident, gray-haired man push toward the trailer gate. He had wire-rimmed glasses on the end of his nose and a cigarette in the corner of his mouth. He dove for a box, his glasses flying, the cigarette embers burning various gutra headdresses and dishdasha skirts. He disappeared for the better part of a minute. Then he came out on the other side of the throng, box under one arm and glasses somehow back on his face, but minus the cigarette. The gray-haired man looked around and delivered an open-handed whack to someone who, I guess, had indulged in a late hit. I stared at the rampage for an hour. Now and then I'd be noticed on the trailer roof. Whenever I caught someone's eye, I was greeted with a big, happy smile. The Iraqis were having fun. Worse fun was to follow. We were out in the countryside, because the first aid convoy to Safwan, 2 days before, had gone into the center of town and had been looted in a less orderly riot. I left the truck roof and interviewed Al-Kandari, or tried to. The doctor was still being importuned for worthless numbers on post-it notes. "We almost get organized," he overstated. "But then some gangs will come from downtown, by running or by truck." They were arriving already, in anything they could get to move. Taxis, pickups, ancient Toyota Land Cruisers, bicycles, Russian Belarus tractors, a forklift, a dump truck. The men from town promptly climbed into the Red Crescent truck. They threw boxes to their buddies. The volunteers fled. In a few minutes, one squad of looters had 17 aid boxes. The box throwers were dancing and singing in the back of the tractor trailer. A reporter who had covered the previous convoy said, "I saw these same guys." He pointed to a wolfish-looking fellow who was pulling the tail of his gutra across his face. "You can tell the really bad ones," the reporter said. "They have shoes." Al-Kandari ordered the driver to start the truck. The British troops cleared the highway. The truck drove back to Safwan with the trailer doors open and the looters still inside. The other looters, in their miscellany of rides, gave chase. Men stood on car hoods and in pickup beds, trying to catch boxes being thrown from inside the trailer. Boxes fell, spraying fruit, rice, and powdered milk across the pavement. A flatbed truck passed us, piled with scores of aid boxes. The men standing on the bumpers had shoes. Horn honking, chanting, and other noises of celebration could be heard in the distance. We drove through Safwan. Boys ran alongside our convoy, managing, with deft coordination of purposes, to jeer and beg at the same time. A reporter tossed a bottle of water to a boy. The boy picked it up and threw it at the reporter. Safwan's houses, placed higgledy-piggledy, were built of tumbling-down mud brick. The other buildings were squat and lumpish, their walls formed of concrete with too much aggregate in the mix, bath, party, adobe. Signs of economic activity were nil. In the one park, playground equipment was rusty and broken. Trash was everywhere. Hundreds of black, plastic shopping sacks blew along the streets, snagging in the rest of the rubbish. The people of Iraq may have had nothing, but they had the bag it came in. Safwan was a dump, but not a ruin. There was little war damage. Coalition forces had destroyed almost nothing but the customs sheds, which hadn't been used since 1991 when the Gulf War ceasefire was signed, as it happened at Safwan. In an hour and a half, we were back in Kuwait City, in the same geography, on the same oil reserves, with the same people, same language, same religion, but Kuwait City is Houston without Enron, or, unfortunately, beer. 12 years ago, Kuwait City was a dump and a ruin. The Iraqis destroyed what they couldn't steal and left the rubble full of their garbage, including piles of human feces. The hotel where the Gulf War press stayed survived only because it had carpets made from some self-extinguishing synthetic fiber. The Iraqis kept pouring diesel oil on the carpets. The flames kept going out. The hotel stank. There was no electricity. The rooftop cisterns ran dry. The only food was eggs, cooked by the hotel staff over campfires in the parking lot. 12 years later, in Kuwait City, I had tea and smoked salmon sandwiches and tarts and cakes and sticky treats with an American lawyer who has lived in Kuwait for 20 years. He was trapped by the 1990 invasion and forced to hide. He described the convoy of empty trucks that came from Baghdad every day, all kinds of trucks, dump trucks included, and returned every night full of swag. He told about the Baghdad buses that were driven to Kuwait carrying members of the People's Army, men and women turned loose in the shopping districts to pull down gates, push in doors, and loot. "The Iraqis," he said, "pried up the reflectors between the lanes in the streets and took them back to Baghdad." Then the lawyer spread his hands to take in the magnificence of the restaurant where we were sitting. "Even after all that," he said, "there was a lot left in Kuwait." The smelly Gulf War hotel, and everything else I remembered, had been rebuilt or replaced. Freedom accomplishes extraordinary things. And there is an extraordinary list of things that Kuwait is free of. Kuwait is free of the Wahhabi religious idealism that inspires neighboring Saudi Arabia. There is an evangelical church in Kuwait City, a Coptic church, and a Roman Catholic Holy Family cathedral complex with crosses 40 feet high on its gable ends. I confess to thinking that one way to get a drink in Kuwait was to take communion, but a priest from India drank all the wine. Kuwait is free of the lofty goals of pan-Arab socialism that animate the Ba'ath Party. Kuwait is also free of the lofty goals that animate other political parties. Political parties are illegal. To vote in Kuwait, one must be basically a son of a family that lived there when oil was something that seeped from the ground and ruined the camel forage. Franchise is denied to women and to most naturalized citizens and to the 62.9% of Kuwait's population, mostly guest workers and their dependents, who aren't citizens at all. The National Assembly is of dubious political power anyway. Kuwait is more majority-owned than majority-ruled. The relatives of Sheikh Jaber al-Ahmed al-Sabah have held control since the 18th century. As a nation, Kuwait has been, arguably, free of freedom itself. Claimed in turn by Constantinople, Riyadh, and Baghdad, Kuwait has survived by playing Turks off Persians, Arabs off one another, and the English off everyone. Kuwait became a British protectorate in 1899. In 1961, the British were asked to leave and immediately asked to return to forestall an invasion by a previous Iraqi strongman, Abdul Karim Qasim. Now, some would say, Kuwait is an American fief. The Kuwaitis are free of resentment about that. Being an American in Kuwait City was like being a minor celebrity come back home to live. Walking through the souks, I was greeted with shy smiles and hellos from fellow shoppers. Merchants invited me to have coffee after I had bought something. In the luggage souk, two shopkeepers left their stores and showed me around until I had bought what I wanted from arrival. The teller at the bank told me he liked my haircut. As the war neared, hotels and shopping centers put metal detectors inside their doors. As I was going into the Salghiya Mall, a security guard saw me start to empty the many pockets of my safari jacket. He got up, helped me out of the coat, carried it around the detector stanchions unsearched, and helped me put it back on. The freedom that Kuwaitis do have is the freedom to do what they want. What they want to do is shop, eat, and sit around. The Kuwaitis are among the few peoples on earth, teenagers aside, who don't sneer at these freedoms. Apparently, they never did. Kuwait's popular traditional museum is devoted to recapturing old Kuwait. Old, being before 1951, when bountiful oil revenues arrived. In the museum's corridors are life-size models of bazaars, food markets, coffee houses, kitchens, and home interiors, all filled with mannequins in period dress, sitting around. Exhibited artifacts include early electric fans, gramophones, Brownie cameras, radios with vacuum tubes, and a set of china commemorating the 1937 coronation of George VI. In the new Kuwait, this freedom of ways and means benefits from means that are prodigious. The McDonald's on Arabian Gulf Street has a doorman and a maitre d'. A Mercedes dealership on the west side of town is the size of a county fair. Premium gasoline costs 87 cents a gallon, or, to put that in Kuwaiti currency, at $3.34 to the dinar, nothing. Lunch lasts from noon to 5. The gutra on the man in line ahead of me at the McDonald's bore the Dunhill label. Souk Shark on Kuwait Bay near the Sheikh's Palace might have been designed by Frank Lloyd Wright if Wright had been alive in 2000 and in need of a quick job to knock off. The souk has its own yacht harbor. Inside the marketplace is a wide central aisle, space that in an American shopping center would be given over to booths selling sunglasses and caps with sports team logos. At Souk Shark, one aisle stall was occupied by the De Beers Diamond Company. As previously noted, Kuwait is not as wealthy as Luxembourg, on paper. But the papers at Souk Shark's newsstand were censored, although it was decolletage rather than economic information that was blacked out with marker pens. Anyway, Luxembourgers may be better at earning, but they cannot excel the Kuwaitis at spending. The Souk's grocery store, the Sultan Center, was Balducci's as Costco. Caviar tins were piled to the ceiling. In the food court, the Chinese counter had Peking duck to go. At a children's clothing store, a toddler play outfit, shirt, jumper, and gym shoes came to $140 worth of jam mop and chocolate milk sponge. The Kukai boutique was filled with the latest in the fashionable ethnic look. Never mind that Kuwaitis are ethnics. I interviewed a Bedouin the next day. He was tending his camel herd in the desert west of the city. He wore sandals and a sail-sized dishdasha. His gutra, not from Dunhill, was tucked in manifold gatherings under the agal headband. On the back of the Bedouin's riding camel was a carved wood and tooled leather footstool of a saddle. The camel's flanks were covered by vividly woven and elaborately tasseled wool provision bags. This was the first time I'd ever seen anyone really use the kind of handicrafts that tourists bring home. The Bedouin milked a mother camel and offered me the bowl. We sat around. He said, "I have three sons in medical school in the United States." The camel's milk was frothy, light, slightly sweet. It would make an excellent latte. The desert sky was cross-hatched with power lines. Pumping stations and tank farms could be seen in the distance. There was a six-lane highway behind the desert patriarch. He was Lawrence of New Jersey. The liberties of Kuwait may be quotidian, but Kuwaitis are serious about them. Even in New Jersey, the right to drive isn't exercised with Kuwaiti vigor. I was on that six-lane highway, going 70 miles an hour in the left-hand lane in bumper-to-bumper traffic, when a Mercedes 500 SE sedan blinked its lights behind me. I had nowhere to go. The Mercedes driver cut left onto the unpaved shoulder and proceeded at 90 or 100 down the barely car-width slot between the traffic and the concrete barrier. I could see his taillights wobble. He was terraplaning, gravel surfing, leaving a mile of stone stars in the windshields of the cars ahead. The small, ordinary freedoms of life are priceless, especially if you remember to have someone else pay the price. Billboards on the backs of Kuwait's city buses show a photograph of a Kuwaiti hugging an American soldier during the 1991 liberation with the caption in English and Arabic, "We never forget." In early March 2003, most American soldiers were too far from town to be hugged. Also, they were about to liberate in the other direction. I wonder whether the Iraqis will say, "We never forget." If so, in what tone of voice will they say it? 2 days before the war began, the President of the United States gave an inspirational speech. "I thought the Bush speech was a little bit inspiring," said a PFC at an Army Aviation Chinook helicopter base in western Kuwait. "Nothing we didn't expect, just a confirmation," a warrant officer said. "We most definitely have more to look forward to now instead of the standstill wait," said a sergeant. She had obtained, somehow, in a Muslim marketplace, a case of pork sausages, and she was cooking lunch for her platoon in scrounged pans over a jury-rigged propane fire. "This is just like being home after work," said a platoon member. "We're enjoying ourselves while we can. It's going to be a longer day once combat begins." Some of the battalion's troops had come from Afghanistan. Kuwait's landscape was bleaker still. 6 sandbags on the floor of each portable toilet, more ballast than portable toilets are given at Ozfest, said everything about the wind. The soldiers had free weights, laptops, though no internet access, and once a week phone calls home. They said they had CDs with a variety of music, country, heavy metal, rap, bluegrass, gospel, alternative rock. But each soldier listened to one variety, not to the others. There was no Tenting Tonight or Lily Marlene in the Walkman headphone army. "Everything is fine, aside from cold showers," said a private. "One day closer to redeployment," said a lieutenant. "Your worst day of waiting is better than your best day of combat," said a captain. Asked about world opinion, peace protests, the UN, and so forth, a helicopter pilot said, "I don't care. We're here to do one thing and one thing only. If they tell me to go hurt someone, I'll go hurt someone. That was a chilling statement of military professionalism, unless it was a heartwarming testimony to what military professionalism means in a democracy with armed forces under civilian control. Either way, the professionalism was different than it was in Kipling's time. A second pilot, leaving base as a sandstorm blew in, said to the first, "If I don't come back, I'm willing you all my tampons." "We came here to do a job," said an enlisted man. "It doesn't matter what we think about it, we've got to do it." Then he added, "I'm doing it for my wife and kids." And each soldier may have been listening to different music, but all the soldiers were not listening to the same tunes. A member of the popular country and western group, the Dixie Chicks, had stated that President Bush made her ashamed to be from Texas. A gunnery officer collected Dixie Chicks CDs to throw out the window of his Chinook. Also, a campaign was discussed to return the Statue of Liberty to the French. Take the bitch back. The previous week, a network anchorman had been scheduled to take a ride on one of the battalion's helicopters. I had happened to be on the base. I asked the private on sentry duty at the landing pad, "Have you seen Peter Jennings?" "No, sir," said the private, "and I don't much like him anyway." At Camp Virginia, in northern Kuwait, amenities were fewer. Hot meals were infrequent. There were long lines for those cold showers. A sergeant took me for a ride in his Bradley fighting vehicle. We went across the desert at terrific speed, terrific being about 45 miles per hour, but in a large armored tracked vehicle, this is like 45 miles per hour down the stairs on a cafeteria tray. As we crested a berm, the sergeant said, "Sometimes I don't know why they pay me." He had been in Kuwait for 6 months. Camp Virginia came back into view. "And sometimes," the sergeant said, "they couldn't pay me enough." His crew wanted to know about my pay. "How much do you get paid to come here?" they asked. "Is this fun for you?" An officer from Army Public Affairs shushed them. I was shown a mobile command post tent carried by 5 trucks and big enough for a circus that's given up aerial acts. But inside, it seemed to be a Wall Street bond trading boiler room. Officers sat at rows of tables, staring at computer terminals. In front of the tables were PowerPoint presentations on 3 large screens. Map displays showed enemy and coalition military positions in the planned initial combat zone, in Iraq as a whole, and in the entire Middle East. The tent was windowless, the better to protect against NBC, nuclear, biological, chemical, threats. The other tents were also windowless. Ordinary soldiers, along with headquarters staff, spend a lot of on-duty time staring at computer terminals, and they spend a lot of time inside NBC suits, behind gas mask lenses, breathing through filters. In the back of the Bradley fighting vehicle, where 6 combat infantrymen sit, the only peek at the outside is through periscopic slits. The Chinooks themselves, if you stand away from the door gunner's post, don't have a view, or they don't unless the crew drops the rear loading ramp. Then you have the disconcerting view you'd get from putting a French window in the floor of your mountaintop house deck. There's something as indoorsy as eBay about the 21st century military, and from all I know about either part of that simile, something as historically transformative. The military is indoorsy, but not homey. The numerous ducts, tubes, and wiring bundles of technology covered by sheetrock and acoustic tile in civilian life, are left there in the Army. The hardware seems to expand with exposure. Austere functionality has so overgrown the interior of the Humvee that only 4 soldiers can fit into that hulking vehicle. Perhaps technology is squeezing humans out of warfare. But will they want to go? A Chinook helicopter crew took me along on a live fire exercise to practice with a door-mounted M60 machine gun. We flew to a range on the northern Kuwait border where Iraqi military junk from the Gulf War had been hauled. One of every so many rounds in the M60's ammunition belt magazine was a tracer, which left a 4th of July rocket trail telling where the bullets were going. I asked if it was like shooting a rifle, aiming precisely, or like shooting a shotgun, leading the target. "It's better than either," said the gunnery officer who had been collecting Dixie Chicks CDs. It's like walking the dog. Bullets ambled along toward a Soviet-era Iraqi tank. Trot, 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 and mess in the yard. Flying back from the firing range, I had a moment of clarity about one of the supposed underlying causes of the conflict in Iraq. The Kuwait desert is as flat as a patio and as big as Connecticut and Rhode Island combined. The entire space appeared to be covered in tanks, artillery pieces, Bradley fighting vehicles, Humvees, transport trucks, and Patriot missile batteries. Streaks of asphalt runway ran in all directions. The tarmac held fighter planes, cargo planes, and hundreds more helicopters, Chinooks, Blackhawks, Apaches, Kiowas. Amid the materiel were Camp Virginia, Camp New York, Camp Pennsylvania, and, the way it looked to me, Camp's other 47 and Camp Puerto Rico and Camp Guam. Military force extended from me to the horizon in every direction, 360 degrees of war. It is much cheaper to buy oil than to steal it. At dawn on Thursday, March 20th, when the first American missiles struck Baghdad, I was asleep in a big, soft bed. My wife, watching late-night news in the United States, called me in Kuwait to tell me the war had started. That was embarrassing for a professional journalist in the combat zone. But I looked around my comfortable hotel room and thought, we are fighting for freedom. In this case, the freedom to go back to sleep in a big, soft bed. I got out of bed, eventually, and went to interview the random bystanders who have become central to news coverage in the contemporary era. About a third of the stores and businesses in Kuwait City were closed. A bomb-sniffing police dog was digging furiously in a concrete planter outside my hotel, which would have been alarming if the dog hadn't had the unmistakable mane of a pooch who smells something deliciously dead. The Kuwaitis I talked to were confident and enthusiastic. The proprietor of a fabric shop said, "America is here. I feel no problem in Kuwait." I went to buy additional pens and notebooks, in case other spokesmen for the Arab street were more loquacious. I asked the stationery store owner about the onset of hostilities. "This is good," he said. "This is better. I want Saddam finish." He told me about seeing a young Filipina raped by Iraqi troops in 1990 outside his shop door. "I could do nothing," he said. "They loot my store. Everything." He put a finger to his temple. "Click," he said. He all but came over the counter with angry enthusiasm. He declared, "I go for a soldier." Then he sighed. "But my son says, you are 67. His Indian shop assistant steered me away from the less expensive pens. Non-Kuwaiti guest workers were less certain about the war, although the stationery store assistant did give me a hug after I had interviewed his boss and bought two boxes of felt tips and a dozen steno pads. "My owner won't let me close," said a Pakistani man at an appliance store. "You ask me, I close. Maybe you will inform him?" The Indian manager of a women's clothing store said, "I think this is not fair. Is for us and everybody not good. Is bad for Saddam Hussein, and very sad because of one person is all this trouble." "You mean because of Saddam Hussein?" I asked. "Yes, Saddam. But you still don't think this war is good?" "Yes." I questioned a Filipino clerk at a photo-developing booth about his decision to come to work. Me. "Some businesses are closed." Clerk. "Sometimes they do not open." Me. "But you're open. You're not afraid?" Clerk. "Some are a little afraid." Me. "How do you feel about the bombing?" Clerk. Polite smile. Me. "The U.S. bombed Baghdad this morning." Clerk. "I did not know about this." Another polite smile. Iraq began firing missiles at Kuwait. Only the first air raid warning had any effect on the Kuwaitis. When the sirens started, I saw a man in a dishdasha come out of an office building and rush nervously toward his car. 15 feet from the vehicle, he stopped and pressed the door lock button on his keychain remote, and then he went back into the office building. There was a mannequin wearing a gas mask in a store's window display, but it turned out that the store sold equipment to the police and military. Plastic sheeting and duct tape were displayed in the hardware souk. "Many sales," said a fellow at one of the stalls, "but not because of the war. because of good price. One of the Kuwaiti soldiers guarding my hotel wanted America to pick up the pace. "Tomorrow, tomorrow, and tomorrow," he exhorted, and made the motion of a baseball umpire calling a runner safe. "Boom," he urged. A tiny old lady wrapped in a black abaya approached me in the vegetable souk. She had the face of Mother Teresa, or rather, the face that Mother Teresa deserved but didn't get. "American?" she asked. "Yes," I said. She gave me a beatific grin, a smile of hope and blessing, and drew her finger across her throat. "Saddam," she beamed. There was no sign of fear or patience among the Kuwaitis, any more than there would be among the Iraqis at Safwan. Sermons could be preached about the civilizing benefits and progressive influences of fear and patience. And I've preached all of them to my 3 and 6-year-old daughters. I suspect I have 1 or 2 elements of the Muslim world in my own home. But only 1 or 2. An article in Kuwait This Month featured the miswak, a twig from the saltbrush tree that is employed as a natural toothbrush. "Muslims use it," the article said, "on the recommendations of Prophet Muhammad." The Prophet is quoted in the text, "Use the miswak, for verily it purifies the mouth and it is a pleasure for the Lord." Not only is there no separation of church and state in the Muslim world, there is no separation of church and dental hygiene. In Arab Times, a Kuwait English language daily, the law court roundup reported that SHF was accused of raping OSM. He took her to an apartment for a tryst, then invited some other men to have sex with her. She refused and was raped. SHF was acquitted. The court ruled that the testimony of the victim cannot be taken into account because during earlier interrogation, she had said SHF had sex with her 3 times and later confessed to having sex 5 times. But just when I had decided that the people of the Middle East were as troubling and confusing as the algebra they invented, there came a glimpse of the brotherhood of mankind, or, apropos of algebra, the brotherhood of sophomoric guy kind. I was in a phone store when a young Kuwaiti married couple came in. They were in their late teens. She was a beauty, though cloaked to the soles of her feet and veiled to the eyes, a girl who is really pretty. Whether she wraps herself in an abaya, a nun's habit, or the front hall rug, never wraps herself so that the world can't tell. The boy was tall and gawky and had a foolish grin. A line of hickeys ran up his neck. The night I returned from Safwan, a missile hit the souk shark. The Kuwaitis claimed it was a seersucker missile. Who names these things? Leftover old preppies at the CIA? Next we'll have the Madras Cummerbund missile and the lime green pants with little trout flies missile. I went to souk shark in the morning. Kuwaiti police officers were lifting the crime scene tape so that all the other fellows could have a look at the cool destruction. The damage wasn't great, but in one perfume shop every bottle had been exploded by the warhead's shockwave. The place reeked of shalimar. A mature adult American with a perfume store would have been on his cell phone screaming at his insurance agent. The Kuwaiti store owner was sitting in a chair sipping a little cup of coffee. I introduced myself. The owner pointed cheerfully to the wet pile of broken glass. "Special price," he said. Being a unilateral reporter in Kuwait, rather than a reporter embedded with the military, meant that, like everyone else, I watched the war on TV. Except I was too close for comfort. To TV, not war. Cable and broadcast networks had taken over swaths of Kuwait's hotels. I was walking down the hall in the Sheraton and saw a huddle of serious-faced ABC television producers. They were having an animated discussion. Something was up. I moved closer. "Do you think we should wake Diane?" "I don't want to wake Diane." "Maybe we shouldn't wake Diane." I started to keep a notebook of things said by people who were sitting behind desks on television. CNN 319, Larry King to John Major, "I don't think the United States has ever started a war." CNN 320, several hours after the decapitation strike against Saddam Hussein, "It is like a brief intermission in some terrible but real movie." CNN 323, concerning a 101st Airborne soldier who threw a grenade into an officer's tent, We'd like to point out that the soldier is said to have an Arab or Muslim-sounding last name, but we'd like to point out that at this time this doesn't mean anything at all. But I gave it up. I'm not prejudiced against CNN. It was just the first station on my hotel room channel changer. Every so often, the unilateral reporters were sent on official minibus tours, such as the one to Safwan. 35 or 40 journalists would pack into the minibus, pressed against the windows like pickles in a jar. The tours were arranged by the Kuwaiti Ministry of Information. The MOI falls under the purview of Kuwait's Department of Moral Guidance and Public Relations, and there is a branch of government that's a boat with two sterns and a big Evinrude on each. The minibuses made a lot of unexplained stops in the desert. At each stop, a small, bossy man from the Ministry of Information shouted through a bullhorn, "Everybody get back on the buses!" Nobody got back on the buses. "We are leaving," shouted the little bossy man. We didn't leave. I went to Umm Qasr, Iraq's only deep-water port. I saw Iraq's least successful looter scurrying down a side street clutching a vacuum cleaner hose, a strip of rubber molding, and the kind of small, dirty throw rug you don't mind if the dog chews. I saw Umm Qasr's port facilities. They had been looted. Umm Qasr was the site of a detention facility for several thousand Iraqi enemy prisoners of war, or EPWs, POW having apparently acquired too much political cachet for use on Iraqis. We were driven by the detention facility so fast that we couldn't see anything, because, we were told, under the Geneva Convention, prisoners of war are not allowed to be exhibited to the press. I was also going to keep a notebook on my own thoughts about the war. Decapitation strike. Cut head off dinosaur. Dinosaurs have brains the size of walnuts. Leaves a lot of thrashing stegosaurus. Was U.S. radio reporter on roof of Nagasaki Hilton in 1945 saying, "Civilian casualties are going to cause problems for the U.S. winning the hearts and minds of the Japanese people"? Military bands embed satellite phones. Iraqis listening in. Getting toward April 15th, Iraqis asking, "Is this H&R Block a new coalition?" PhD dissertation to be written about the relationship of 24-hour war coverage to reality TV. Glad I'm not in grad school. Will Boston Pops give concert featuring TV Network's War in Iraq theme music? Geraldo expelled for sketching U.S. positions in sand on live TV. Given Geraldo investigative journalism track record, resulted in Iraqi artillery pounding Damascus. But I gave that up, too. Geraldo appeared at my hotel, looking dramatically dirty, and accompanied by enough equipment and crew to re-invade Iraq. With the Pentagon's blessing, he soon did. The troops like him, an Army public affairs officer explained. And why not? Geraldo is courageous, patriotic, and without him, the troops aren't on TV. Besides, a reporter didn't have to be foolishly brave to feel like a fool during the war. Thousands of Kuwaiti citizens and residents were imprisoned in Iraq in 1990 and 1991. 605 are still unaccounted for. Kuwait's National Committee for Missing and Prisoner of War Affairs held a reception for POW families and the press. Solemn and formally dressed Kuwaitis presented journalists, who were almost as grubby as Geraldo, with yellow roses, lapel pins, POW-MIA banners, and letters written by family members. One was from a daughter of a POW and was addressed to the whole world, to everyone who live on our good and blessed earth. Tables of food had been set out. Waiters circulated with glasses of fruit juice. The room was decorated with the yellow ribbons that have gone, in good thief on cavalry fashion, from self-pitying refrain in a country and western prison song to international symbol of hope and remembrance. There was no tactful way to escape interviewing the families. I was with a Lebanese journalist friend who offered to translate. He guided me to two sisters wearing yards of stiff, shiny black cloth, Mona and Naima. They're Bedouin women, my friend said, from a very humble background. You can tell by how dark they are from the sun. This is the only place you'd see them mix with wealthy Kuwaitis. Mona and Naima's three brothers, aged 19 to 24, were arrested by the Iraqis in 1990. Why were they arrested? I asked. They were in the Kuwait army, said Mona. Naima was arrested too. She was a nurse. The Iraqis asked her to work in a hospital in Iraq. She refused and was sent to prison for 4 months, first in Basra, then in Najaf, then in Karbala. Her daughter was 7 months old. The girl, now a 13-year-old in jeans, was at the reception with her mother and aunt. Naima hadn't known that her brothers were held in the same prison she was. She caught a glimpse of them as she was being moved from Basra to Najaf. 3 years ago, Mona spoke with a former POW who recalled seeing her eldest brother in prison in 1991. That was all they knew. "I'm the scum of the earth," I said to my Lebanese friend. "Our business eats these things. We're maggots in people's grief. And we can't even keep a story like this in the news for more than one Oprah episode. There's nothing I can do. There's worse than nothing. I'm a beacon of false hope, a Cape Hatteras lighthouse in downtown Raleigh." Or I said something like that, probably not so carefully thought out. My friend spoke to the two women. They looked at me with concern and said something in Arabic. "They are firm believers in Allah," my friend said. "Whatever their brother's fate is, they're willing to accept it, knowing that their brothers served Kuwait and served it well." Baghdad fell. Iraqi rioting commenced. Looting was undertaken in earnest. 24-hour television coverage turned into the shopping channel. The war was over. Not the killing, dying part, but the part in which I was involved. I could tell by a sign on the bulletin board at the Kuwaiti Ministry of Information Press Center. "For sale. Helmet, U.S. Army, medium, like new, $100. Flak vest, concealable, worn once, $350. Newscasters began mentioning the Lacey Peterson murder case. Some attributed the lapsing scrutiny of the war to the short attention span of the American public, but many Americans have given their all, indeed, could be said to have sacrificed their lives, doing their best for people who now hate them. A nation that has teens in the house can't be expected to focus on Iraq forever. On April 16th, I hitched a ride on an Air Force C-17 cargo plane to the Baghdad airport. Bouncing around in the windowless cargo hold was an Oshkosh fire engine. "A fire engine?" said the Army public affairs officer who took charge of me in Baghdad and whom I'll call Major Bob. "We've already got a fire engine. What we need is water to put in it." Thousands of troops occupied the airport. Their water was in 1-liter plastic bottles. Sometimes there was a little water left over from drinking. Then a shower could be had by poking holes in the bottom of the water bottle, holding it right side up, and unscrewing the cap. Hot meals were unavailable. The meals ready to eat are less of a death penalty to the digestive system than they were during the Gulf War, and more of a life sentence to the school lunchroom. The weather was hot and windy in the daytime and hot and windy at night. Troops and supplies were being flown into the airport's cargo facilities. The passenger terminal, designed by French architects in a Harrah's Arabia style, was being used as a bivouac. The combination of no planes at the gates, dull food, non-functioning air conditioning, and snoring people stretched out on uncomfortable boarding lounge furniture made for a shock of the familiar to a frequent flyer. Except you could smoke. Except everyone was running out of cigarettes. There was an ad on the airport wall for the place where Iraq's information minister, Mohammed Saeed al-Sahaf, used to regale the international press. "Al-Rashid, it's more than a hotel." "It's a target," an army captain said. I camped in the airport's administration building, in an office with bookshelves full of Reagan-era Boeing manuals and out-of-date Jepson guides to takeoff and landing patterns at international airports. I did not find one for LaGuardia with the World Trade Center towers circled in red. What I found instead was culture, or evidence of it. Looting by Americans was strictly forbidden, but scrounging was okay, and we didn't have coffee cups. The Iraqi airport administrators had a wall of personal lockers, all carefully locked, but with doors subject to persuasion by a Leatherman tool. I found a cup in one locker and, along with a bag of loose tea, a sliver of soap, and a spare pair of socks, the crudely printed cover of an English-language Iraqi edition of Waiting for Godot. Artistic genius arguably including Samuel Beckett's, has limned the extraordinary experiences of war. Terror, desperation, suffering, bravery. Banal discomforts, however, need less brilliant insights to convey them. For example, sandstorm. The word is to beach, to playground. And Iraq doesn't have sand. It has fine ground goat droppings and minute particles of gluey clay. When the wind whips up, it's small craft warnings in the lizard terrarium, a horizontal dirt blizzard. Then the drizzle that comes with spring sandstorms in the Persian Gulf begins, and with every breath, the soldiers are fed a slime pie. Months of that, and the food, and the water, plus those extraordinary experiences of war, such as getting shot at, are wearing. The lavatory facilities at the airport administration building consisted of one plastic stacking conference room chair with a hole cut out of the seat. It was placed over a bucket behind the "To Baghdad" sign on the departure ramp. The soldiers guarding a presidential palace near the airport had been in the Gulf since the previous July. Their lieutenant had been killed in the war. A sergeant said that his wife, unable to get a babysitter, had taken their 5-year-old daughter to the lieutenant's funeral in the United States. "One of Daddy's soldiers is on his way to heaven," his wife explained. "You mean he died," said the little girl. When they got home, the girl took a tablet and pencil and went into her bedroom. The sergeant often receives elaborate scribbles in the mail. Half an hour later, his daughter came out and said, "Usually I write Daddy, but you'll have to write this so he can understand it. Daddy, be safe. Come home in one piece." Another soldier was carrying a chrome-plated winged victory in his pocket. His 13-year-old son's soccer team had won the league championship. His son broke the angel off the top of the trophy and sent it with a note. "This will protect you." Sergeant Luis Cubera was a New York City emergency medical technician. Major Bob said he was in Tower 1 when Tower 2 got hit. "It gave me a reason to come back in the Army," said Sergeant Cubera. The palace was called, I think, Abu Ghraib, but Iraq's presidential palaces are marked with barbed wire and watchtowers, not park service signs or historical plaques. The palace was built on an artificial island in a fish pond big enough for water skiing. There was a swamped speedboat in the shallows. Some soldiers had removed whip antennas from Humvees and rigged the antennas with communication wire and safety pins. A fish fry was planned. The palace architecture hinted that Iraq had a heritage. There was a dome and a bunch of pointy arches and some elaborate scribbles in Arabic around the front door, which was 3 stories high. Scale, proportion, and ornamental detail were those of the Ritz-Carlton Tomb of Hammurabi or the Great Mosque in Disney World's Muslim Land. The palace was badly built. Shoddy, rubble wall construction was skimmed with a thin layer of concrete. Lines were scored in the cement, faking the seams of quarried stone. A missile had blown off the back of the palace, exposing its crawl spaces and utility rooms. The PVC plumbing and low-grade electrical wiring looked like things strewn around by a trailer park tornado. Inside, materials were marble, alabaster, mahogany, teak, and mother-of-pearl, elaborately handcrafted by badly skilled workmen. The main reception room was 4 floors high. A crystal chandelier hung down past 2 tiers of balconies. I paced off the shadow it cast on the floor. The chandelier was the size of a 2-car garage. If a reason to invade Iraq was wanted, felony interior decorating would have done. Imagine Liberace as an inner-city high school basketball star who had just signed an NBA contract and converted to Islam. Returning to the airport from the palace, Major Bob and I saw civilians being searched at one of the checkpoints. A village that housed Iraqi airport workers was inside the airport security perimeter. Some of the villagers had fled during the war, now they were coming back, but they had to be frisked first. For propriety's sake, the women were asked to frisk themselves. They patted their chadors, or their jeans and t-shirts, with both hands from ankles to shoulders, maintaining a neutrality of expression that was admirable in a forced Macarena. Najah Rahim, age 51, had been hired by the Army to interpret at the checkpoint for $3 a day. "What did you do before the war?" Major Bob asked him. I was an air traffic controller. I'm probably living in your office, Major Bob said. Nadja suggested that we go to the village called the French Quarter because it was built originally for the airport's French construction crews. They will be eager to talk to you in the French Quarter.